And Venerable Robina is here.
Unmute. There we go. Yeah. Down the bottom of the picture. That's all I can do. Buddha's there. Nine here. And it's a bit wobbly. I want to make it nice. Hang on a minute. This is ridiculous. I can't do any better. Sideways. Did we try sideways before? It doesn't work. Hang on a minute, people. Oh dear, what to do? Okay. Can you hear me? Am I on yet?
We can hear you. You hear?
Okay, so this is the best I can do. So there's Buddha. And there's me. All right?
All right.
Okay, darlings, our final talk. Let's do our wee prayers again, Donna.
Okay.
Little motivation. Again, I can only see about three of you, which is great. I'm most unfortunate, but never mind. What can we do? Our pads are useless. Computers are much better. Okay, darling, so we're thinking, we're here together. That's the dedication prayers. It's a bit better. Okay, so this is, hang on, I've got to go. Hang on a minute, I'm not quite ready. I'm not quite comfortable. Just a minute. Won't be a second. It's very tricky here. Better. All right. Okay, so we're gonna talk, think, listen, analyze, contemplate the meaning of these words, and that includes me, I promise. Dependent arising and emptiness, which is everything. Everything leads us to that, so that we can develop our amazing potential. So we can give up the fears and the dramas of samsara, so we can be blissful, so we can help others. That's why we're here together. Sangye chodong soke chong nam la, chong chu baru dagni kyab su ti, dagi chun yen ge sonam ki, drora penche sangye drupa shok. Sangye chadang soke chong nam la, chang chu baru dagni kyab su chi, dagi chun yen pe sonam ki, drora penche sangye drupa shok. Sangye chadang soke chong nam la, chang chu baru dagni kyab su chi, dagi chun yen gi pe sonam ki, drora penche sangye drupa shok. Okay. So, what we've done is over this period, we've looked at the main thing I'm trying to get over that we need to see is this is a specific topic, you know, and you could study it for 5 years, just this topic. But what's always important is to see the topic within the bigger picture. Then I think it's much more meaningful to us. I think our biggest problem, certainly in the West, when we hear Buddhist teachings, we just hear them as these isolated pop-up teachings, and it really takes us a while to see the relationship between them all. And that's huge. It's a bit like you're studying math, but you can't see the connection between that and algebra and all the other things. So it's a bit sort of, you've got to have a big picture. You've got to have the big picture. And often we forget that that's what's here in the Buddhist path, you know. And so if we look at the Lam Rim, as we've been discussing from the beginning, we look at the Lam Rim, this presentation of all the Buddhist teachings from Tsongkhapa, our lineage Lama. It's obvious that everything in the earlier stages has to lead you to the middle stages, like junior school has to lead to high school. Everything in the middle scope, which is, you know, high school, I call it, has to lead you to university. And then that leads you to postgraduate. It's sort of obvious. And when we really can understand this, then we can join the dots, you know. And so when we start the Lam Rim, we abide by the laws of karma. We try to be nice, good girls and boys, and don't kill and don't steal and don't lie. I mean, emptiness is the furthest from our mind, you know. But all we all know, as you learn to more and more take on board the teachings about karma, you start to realize that, wow, that's an interesting example of dependent arising. And, you know, guess what? Dependent arising, like, you hear it in the different teachings over, you haven't studied it properly yet, but you get to get the idea. The dependent arising, as Lama Yeshe puts it, is the king of logics. to prove emptiness. Well, that's interesting. If karma is dependent, if karma is an example of dependent arising, and it is, because one of the first levels of dependent arising, we've talked about this, is cause and effect. Well, guess what? Karma is cause and effect for the product, for the phenomenon called me. So that's interesting. That must help me understand emptiness. Oh, never heard of that before, never thought of that before. But when it does occur to us, it begins to really help us. So let's look even briefly at how abiding by the laws of karma can loosen the grip of ego grasping. Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, look at what it contradicts. What the view of karma contradicts is that I'm this innocent victim who didn't ask to get born, to whom bad and good things happen unfairly or fairly, with no, I don't have much say in it. That's the way ego feels. Ego feels like this innocent victim. Lama Yeshe would say it's the self-pity me who feels that things happen to me and we don't know anything about it. That's the fear of samsara. That's what samsara is. And Buddha says it's a load of nonsense. In fact, you have everything to do with what happens to you, honey. You didn't begin in your mother's womb. You don't come from a creator. You don't come from your mother's genes and DNA. Your body does, no problems, but not your mind, honey. That comes from your past. So that's the concept of karma. So if we take that on board seriously, then we start to realize we're in charge, which means that loosens the grip of being the self-pity victim, which is beginning to get the sense of where's the intrinsic me that, you know, didn't ask to get born. You won't find one. So it's very powerful, you know. It helps us grow up. We learn to take responsibility. We learn to realize that we are the boss. We are in charge of both our happiness and our suffering. You know, it's very powerful. Now, if we don't put karma into practice, and it's very hard for most people, then, of course, it won't occur to you that it's going to help you realize emptiness. Oh, can I have teachings on emptiness, please? Well, you want to think about karma first. Oh, no, I don't like karma. Well, I'm sorry. You're not get very far. It's sort of like you're bored by multiplication, so you don't want to learn that. You just want to learn physics. I'm sorry, you can't do it. They all relate. Now, okay, that's the first one. That's the junior school. That's the lower scope. Now we get to the middle scope and we start to get into our own minds. We start to understand the root of our problems, which is all the delusion. We learn to become our own therapists, as Lama Yeshe puts it, you know. So that means we're really going to learn to unpack and unravel our minds. And then we begin to see, of course, that attachment and anger and all the delusions are the source of so much pain. They're disturbing emotions. Like I said last week or the week before, that's the overt teaching. That's the obvious teaching, the explicit teaching. But we gradually learn by understanding the mind. We start to hear the teachings and we start to hear that these disturbing emotions have another function, and this is the key function, and this is why they cause us to suffer, is that they are misconceptions. They are misconceptions, you know. I'm doing a little teaching. I'll call back. Excuse me. So it's a misconception, and that's a surprise. I mean, first you think of anger, and you see a person shouting and yelling and the spit coming out their mouth and they're having a mental breakdown, and you say they're having a misconception. It sounds initially like a joke. This is not the way modern psychology talks. But when you start to understand the mind in more depth and you learn to know that the key function of all the neuroses, the disturbing emotions, is that they are rooted in being misconceptions, being wrong assessments of reality. So attachment is an exaggeration of the deliciousness of something. Anger is the exaggeration of the ugliness of something. They are distorted. They're distorted. They're deluded, distorted assessments of something. Then we get to see that. Now, this really prepares us. When we finally get to the bodhisattva path, we start to develop compassion and bodhicitta, and then we're on the six perfections. And the final stages of the six perfections, we now get into getting concentration meditation, which is a prerequisite for getting the realization, the insight into the ultimate way that things exist. That is to say, it's emptiness. And now our minds are ripe and ready, you know. Of course, you know, His Holiness often says, because all we Western people, we modern people, are so super educated, we are very amenable to the idea of listening to dependent arising from day one, which is marvelous. That's great. But really, our minds are thoroughly prepared, experientially, emotionally, psychologically, if we practice the whole path. And that's the thing that really takes us time to realize that this entire lamrim is a psychological process. You know, it just looks like a bunch of philosophical ideas to us. But the more we become familiar with these things, the more we realize that, you know, it's an experiential internal path. You know, priming our body and priming our mind first by controlling the servants of the mind, your body and speech, then getting into the mind itself, then adding bodhicitta to the mix, and now the six perfections, and finally we're ready to get some concentration, and then with concentration, even a semblance of it, where our minds are ripe and ready to start to unpack and unravel the root delusion, you know. So we talked a bit about this last week. We discussed buying Donna at, wasn't it? We bought a Donna at IKEA. We ordered one Donna. We discussed that. And that's a really good, one of the many, many debates we need to do in our mind to understand how there can't be an intrinsic I in there, you know, among the parts, you know. So the, like we did last week, the usual way we approach that, the usual way we approach it is, you know, we need to look into, we need to start searching the entire package of me or Donna, not the bits. That's the reverse process, which is a very helpful one. But the other one that's usually in the teaching is you take the entire piece of me and you start to look at the different pieces that make up me and try to find the piece that's called I. We find the piece that's called eye, ear, nose, teeth, tongue, love, hate, jealousy. There are millions of bits. And what, and the process is to try and search very carefully for another bit that isn't those bits, but which is a bit that we think is the boss bit without which we wouldn't function, called I. And that's why that IKEA example is such a great one. This is the reverse one. You get all the bits. And this is the point. You get all the bits. This is one of the arguments you have to use for why there isn't, there can't be, and we don't need one anyway, as we discussed last week, a separate piece called self, I, me, Rabina, Donna, whatever your name is, put the label on it, you know, which is what ego instinctively feels. We discuss this. Our language says it. We, you know, the central player in our head is the one called I, you know, isn't it? And so naturally, this is an interesting point. When we, this is like one of the arguments you have to use. When you say the word, any word, it has to have a valid basis. So we used the example last week of, you know, when I use it, the simple example of I have an iPhone Yeah, I've got to be skinny because I'm not on the computer. I usually can put them out here. We're going to put them here. I have an iPhone. Here's the iPhone. And a thermos, okay? So that's three nouns, isn't it? One's a pronoun. Thermos, I, iPhone. It's pretty straightforward. That is three phenomena. They have, this is the logical argument they call if one or many. It sounds so silly initially. If something exists, it has to be one or more than one. It's hardly complicated. So that's a good example. This is a simple example. I, number one phenomenon. So when I say the word I, among other phenomena, it's easy. I am the label that does fit among those three nouns. The label I is correct for this one. For this one. So iPhone is the correct one to this one. Thermos is the correct one to this one. So we can easily add those up and we can say that there's an I, there's a thermos, and there's an iPhone. Three phenomena. And in this simple example, they are independent, separate, they're separate and different. It's an easy example. But like we all discussed, and this is where the tricky part comes, we'll make this other, another statement and we'll say, I have a nose and an ear. So we've got to, it's got to be the same discussion. If it's a true statement, it's got to be the same. We've got to find three separate phenomena. So this is a gross mistake we make because we believe there's the ear, there's the nose, and in here somewhere, and we've never done the analysis, we believe there is another component that is labeled I. So that's why the IKEA example is good. We have each of those pieces. They're named. This is the, you know, the left leg, the right leg, the first big toe, the little toe, the nose, the ear, the eye, all the pieces, and we gradually construct a Donna, construct a me. And you're being very rigorous. And IKEA, we know perfectly well, know the pieces that make up a Donna, so they've given us the correct number of pieces, like whether it's a wardrobe, a table, or a Donna. They're very good. They'll give you the correct number of pieces. So, of course, this is a good, this is the other argument that they say in the text is, because IKEA didn't exist at the time of the Buddha, you didn't build, you know, didn't think like that, but you have to look into the different pieces that are in, that make up the me, and then we have to Because if there is a thing that exists, this is the thing, if there is a phenomenon that does exist, you have to name it, you have to define it, and it has to have a function. So this is the argument. It has to have a name, it has to have a definition and a function. So we know very well what the ear's job is. We know what the job of the nose is. We know what the job of the teeth is. And every tiny part, if you're a brilliant anatomist, you would know the job of every single piece of Rabina's body. If you're a good psychologist, a Buddhist psychologist, you'd know every function of each part of Rabina's mind. That's the rigor we need to have, the level of detail. So when you've got it super clear, the job of each piece that makes up I, you will find, even if there were a piece that IKEA put into the box that tricked Donna, that they put in a piece called I, and she's so relieved to find it. But once she's got the whole of Donna constructed, all the body and all the pieces of the mind all in place, she will discover that there is no job left over for an I. So what the commonest job we think an I has is to be the boss, isn't it? To run the show. The I makes the decision. Well, let's look at that. No, you've got body and mind, remember? There are two parts of a person, and a person is made up of body and mind, and that's it. So, you know, the part that does the deciding is a part of the mind. So, in fact, you know, there's many parts of our mind. If we look at the Buddhist model of the mind, you've got the different emotions, negative ones, positive ones, and then you have the mechanics of the mind. Intention, attention, discrimination, concentration, mindfulness. There's many of these that are like the mechanics of the mind. I use that term, that enable us to function. So, you know, if you say a simple thing like, I am holding an iPhone. Let's analyze that statement, and we're going to find, first of all, the body. There's many parts of the body that have to do the job of holding the iPhone. So the index finger has a job, the middle finger has a job, the ring finger, the little finger, the thumb, the muscles, the ligaments, every piece of my hand, and indeed you start going up the arm and the elbow. If you really did an analysis, you would allocate the pieces that are involved in holding an iPhone, and you'd give a job to each piece. That would be reasonable, wouldn't it? But now then, that another way of saying it is, well, what job is left over for I, the poor little I that's been left out? Well, you won't find a job. You don't need one. We don't need a piece called I. We generally think it's the boss. No, mind is the boss. Now, which part of the mind does what? Well, intention. Think, intention is the meaning of karma. It's the beginning of everything. Intention is I will. So intention is I will hold the iPhone in my right hand. Then attention homes in, and then concentration, mindfulness, discrimination, alertness, they all do their job. The fingers do their job. Each piece of the body, each piece of the mind has a job, and they don't get all upset. Like the pinky is not saying to the ring finger, go away, you're doing my job. They've all got their own job. And you don't have any job left for an eye. I mean, this sounds so silly to us because the assumption is so primordial that there is an eye in there and it's the control freak. It does all the deciding. But that's a misconception. No, it doesn't. We say that, now this is the part that's difficult now. The example before, there are three separate independent phenomena. But here, ear, here's the ear, here's the nose. And where's the eye? That isn't the ear, that isn't the nose. You won't find one. But that doesn't mean there's no eye. This is the part that gets infuriating. Like, please, Buddha, make up your mind. Is there an eye or isn't there? But the eye that does exist, as Lama Zopa says, is so subtle. It's as if it doesn't exist. But the eye that doesn't exist is the one we think exists, which is an independent eye, a separate eye. Like you point out the ear, you point out the nose, and you point out the eye. Now, the Christians call it a soul. They think there is one. The Hindus call it an Atman, a self, absolutely. The Greeks call it an essence. We instinctively believe there is something in there labeled I, ego, essence, but the Buddha says, no, you won't find a piece called that. But it doesn't mean there is not a Donna. The way Donna exists, not as if there's no Donna. Saying there's no Donna is nihilistic. There is a Donna. but not a separate Donna. And that's the part that's hard to hear. So in other words, Donna, there's two things, there's several things. There's body and mind, which are the basis of the label Donna. Here's the parts here are the basis for the label iPhone. The parts here are the basis for the label thermos. So we say there is a thermos. Without analysis, it's the truth. There is Donna. Without analysis, it's the truth. But we overestimate, over-exaggerate some Donna-ness in there, some thermos-ness in there. And we kind of just believe there has to be this intrinsic something there. It's totally instinctive. And that's why it's so hard to see it's a mistake. Because we've so totally believed that this is true, but it's so instinctive. We've never pointed it out. We've never done the analysis. And this is what we have to do. And this, of course, it sounds so silly. It sounds like intellectual nonsense to us initially. But it's fundamentally necessary, you know. So this is the point. If there were one an ear, two a nose, and three an eye, like somewhere in here in the middle, we think it's vaguely there, you know. This is what I said last week. When Donna says, oh, Rabina, you've got such an ugly nose, and I'll say, how dare you insult me? And she will say very truthfully, Rabina, I didn't insult you, I insulted your nose. And of course, we'd all laugh at that. We feel it's me, you know. She said, now, there are two mistakes we make. One is to think there's a separate me, and this is the one we've been doing so far. But the other mistake we make is that we think all of the bits are me. So one of the commonest things we are, when we think about, you know, when we ask to think about what we think, where do we think the I is? The commonest one we come to, and this is in most of the Buddha's teachings, except for the Prasangika Majjhimika, they all say there is something that has to bear the label I, and it's usually a part of the mind. So that's the one that would make sense, because the mind is what continues from life to life. So if you think the I is there somewhere, we tend to think it must be the mind. But now this is the discussion. If the mind were the I, that means the word mind and the word I are synonymous. That means they mean exactly the same thing. You wouldn't separate them. There's two words for the one thing. They are synonymous. So if it is true that your mind, your I is your mind, then why would you say, I have a mind? That's schizophrenic. The mind is the I. How silly. And if you say, the mind is the I, that means I and mind are the same. They have to be identical. They have to be completely synonymous. You couldn't separate them. So it would be foolish to say, I have a mind. I mean, this sounds kind of like a trite argument, but it's logical. Because we're doing everything in our power frantically to reassert that there is a little I in there, a precious little I that runs the show, that gets hurt, that feels this, that is that, that does this. Our language expresses it. And so, of course, we buy into that story, you know. So as His Holiness said, I quoted this, His Holiness said, the I isn't empty of existing from its own side because you can't find it. You can't. But that's not the real premise. The I is empty of intrinsic existence. The I is empty of self-existence. The I is empty of existing from its own side. The I is existing, is empty of inherently existing. The I is empty of intrinsically existing. They're like quite a few synonyms. The I is empty of independent existence because it's a dependent arising. That's the two truths. That's why the king of logic, to prove emptiness, to guarantee, as Tsongkhapa puts it, that we don't fall into the abyss of the great mistake. That is to say that the I is empty, but that tells us that it's a dependent arising. So the simple way of putting it is, dependent arising is a word for how things do exist. Emptiness is a word for how things don't exist. And they're just different ways of presenting the same thing. So when we can begin to understand, when we hear emptiness, that it means dependent arising. And if we hear dependent arising. We know it means emptiness. And if we practice getting used to that, getting our intellectual head around that, then we will never, as Tsongkhapa says, fall into the abyss of the great mistake. Because the commonest feeling deep in our bones when we hear there is no I from its own side, the feeling is, ah, well, there is no I, therefore it doesn't matter. That's the nihilistic view. And so total, that's falling into the abyss of the great mistake. And this is the commonest on the planet, apparently, the commonest interpretation of emptiness, misinterpretation. So it's crucial. And it's so intense to do this. It's so easy. We all say, well, it's all empty, so it doesn't matter anyway. That's a nihilistic statement. It actually, the correct statement is it's all empty, so it does matter. It's the opposite, you know. Because dependent arising is proved by emptiness, and emptiness is proved by dependent arising. So, of course, there are three levels of dependent arising. Karma, cause and effect, is the first example. Parts is the second one that leads us to the subtlest one. And let's discuss this one now, because this is the only level Lama Zopa ever talks at, is merely labeled. That everything lacks. The first one is that there's nothing existing that impermanent phenomena. There's nothing existing that isn't, you know, there's no I that isn't the product of causes. There's no I apart from the parts. This is the second one. And finally, there is no I apart from, separate from, independent of the mind calling it I. This is the merely labeled one. And of course, it's the subtlest. It's the subtlest, as Lama Zopa says, the subtlest dependent arising and the subtlest emptiness. So in one sense, it's quite easy. In one way, we can understand it, you know. And this is the way we can apply it every day in daily life. It's so tasty. You know, even the simplest example, Lama Zopa uses the simplest example. When you first learn from your school teacher the alphabet, you know, and these days probably you don't have blackboards anymore and chalk. We probably have iPads or something, but whatever. When I was a little girl, we had a blackboard. So there she was. She wrote in chalk, didn't she, in the teacher, Miss Holton. I remember her at the convent. I love Miss Holton. She was, when I was five, but she had bright red lipstick. It was 1949. She had bright red lipstick and this beautiful smell. My mother mustn't have worn perfume. Because Miss Holton wore perfume, and I adored Miss Holton. I was in love with Miss Holton. I think she must have looked at me once and said I was a nice girl. I don't know, but I was in love with Miss Holton. Anyway, Miss Holton taught me about the letter A. So she would have written on the board a line going that way, a line going that way, and a little line in the middle. Now, we know this. Now, I didn't know anything about A, did I? It was just three little kind of lines. We know that. We know that very well. So Miss Holton said, this is A. So initially you go, oh, that's A. But you're still just seeing three lines, isn't it? But once you memorize it, what happens is this. You start to then go, oh, that's A. And so what happened is this. In the beginning, you didn't know it was A. Because it isn't A. It's the basis for the label A. This is the right way to say it. So strictly speaking, we say, there's Donna. Now, without analysis, it's true. She's not Fred. But when you start getting really analytical, the correct way to put it is, there is the person labeled Donna. There's the person called Donna. And it's a very good practice for ourselves to think, well, you know, I am the person called Donna, instead of I, Donna, you know, you loosen the grip that way. That's why that lovely story I told, I think, about Lama Zopa drowning when he was 8 years old. He was from his past life a great yogi, so he'd already had realized emptiness. And even though he was drowning, as he said, I didn't know anything about emptiness, you know, when he was drowning. There was no fear. But he said to himself, huh, the person known as the Lao Tzu Lama is about to die. He didn't say, I am about to die, which is how we would feel. There was no panic or fear because he had understood emptiness from his past life. And once you've understood emptiness, you can't lose it. But he said those words. He was eight. The person known as the Lao Tzu Lama is about to die. I mean, it sounds so extraordinary to us to think like this, that there would be no fear. But this is the point, you know. So it's a good exercise. The person known as Donna, you know, the person known as Rabina, whatever. So where was I before? Why did I say that? God, where was I? Was that a swimming man? Maybe labeled. Yeah, the A. Okay, right. So we have to. So then, what happens is in the beginning, it's true that that is the three lines, and then we correctly, validly, our mind imputes the meaning A onto those three lines. And in the beginning, we kind of know that within 1 millisecond, and once we start to learn it, this is the way the ego grasping works. We forget that we were the ones who labeled it A. We imputed it with our mind. It was not intrinsic in those lines. And what's the proof of that? This is the point. The proof that it's not intrinsically A is that if it were, the moment you saw it, without any education, you would say, there is A. And we don't say that. Now, in my kitchen, I can't turn the lamp, it's complicated. My little iPad's all caught up with something. I can't move a video while people are spotlighted. There you go, just telling me I can't do it. So down the end of my kitchen, I've got one room, it's about 19 feet, and my little end is the kitchen, and I've got a beautiful Om Mani Padme Hum printed in gold on blue. Now, I have never learned, all these years I'm mortified to admit it, but I've never learned Tibetan. And I know it's Om Mani Padme Hum because people tell me it is. But every time I look, I just see shapes. I don't see Om Mani Padme Hum, which is a good thing, because if it were intrinsically Om Mani Padme Hum, I'd know it already. I'd say, oh, look, there's Om Mani Padme Hum. If a weed were intrinsically a weed, you look in the garden and you go, oh, there's a weed. But you don't know that until you learn botany. What's Donna doing? She's talking. Who are you talking to, Donna? She's memorizing something.
I'm saying Tara mantras to keep a good connection, Venerable Rabina.
Donna, you're so funny. So it's sort of these things, we kind of know it, but because the mistake is so primordial, we don't get it. We don't join the dots, you know. It's like we don't join the dots. So this is why the powerful practice. Prabhupada Rinpoche says something like, even if we don't even know the meaning of emptiness, but just to think that things don't exist in the way they appear to us. In other words, when we learn about the mind and attachment and anger, and we realize that attachment makes the cake look more delicious than it is, and anger makes your ex-ugly boyfriend look more ugly than he is, and you catch your mind buying into that ugly boyfriend, you say to yourself, Rabina, give it a break. Anger is making up a story. Don't believe it. This is like putting atomic bombs under the delusions, I tell you. So, of course, the emptiness mistake is more subtle. That's why it's so powerful to learn in the middle scope about the branch delusions and how they are distorted misconceptions, you know. This is preparing us, like I said, for this root misconception. So, yeah. So the subtlest one, in some sense, it appears easy to understand, you know. And especially, I mean, I use prisoners. My friends in prison. You know, one woman, I always quote the story about her. She's not a Buddhist. I met her. I heard about her before, after she got out of prison. She wrote a memoir and things, and now she's my friend, and my Bodhicitta Trust supports her a little bit every month, her projects. She was accused of murder back in the 70s. She was with a hippie husband and hippie kids fishing in Florida. They picked up two guys. The guys were stopped by the police. The guys killed the police and blamed the hippie, so they're on death row. The husband even got executed. His head burst into flames. I mean, you can't imagine the nightmare. 17 years of living hell. But she was this amazingly, I'd say, emotionally intelligent woman. I have to say, this miracle. She didn't have much anger. And I think that's a really powerful point. We don't think that much in our world. Because anger is the response when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And that's why we go crazy. That's why we go completely out of our brains when really bad things happen. So this was on death row. Lost her kids. Her family got killed in a car accident. Husband got executed. Brains burst into flames. She's on death row, 17 years. She finally gets out. I think death row for 12, another 5 years to get out of prison eventually. And the people who did it finally confessed or something. I don't remember the details. But just, she wrote a memoir and things. Just, this is the thing that blew my mind. First of all, she said to me in general, I knew I had the choice to change my mind. And she said at some point, I remember reading it somewhere, she said, finally, I realized I couldn't change anything, but they couldn't take my mind from me. So this is the point. This is the thing that's so profound. She said, I decided I am not a prisoner. I am a monk. I am not in a cell. I'm in a cave. Now that's putting into practice exactly this teaching about emptiness. So one time His Holiness was asked, how have you put emptiness into practice in daily life, Your Holiness? Because it all sounds so complicated to us. And he said, and it's so simple, and this is exactly the point. He said, try and see something from another point of view. So what does that mean? What that woman just did? She relabeled her experience. She called it something different. Now, she's not living in a fantasy land because she's not stupid. She knows it's still a prison, but she decided to not have anger towards it. She decided to make the most of it, which is really what's behind that. So that's why she said, I decided I am not in a cell. I'm in a cave. Now, this is the interesting point. In order to establish something as existing, just conventionally, which is just conventional world, you have to do two things. So I will say to my mummy, what's that? Well, she will give the label. She will give the name for it. She'll say, that's called a thermos. Then I will tell her, what is it, mummy? And she will give me the definition. And that has two parts. The first part, well, she'll say, well, as you can see, darling, it's a flat-bottomed metal container. And I can get to see that. But I have to have the second part of the definition. And this is a crucial piece of information. I will say, but mummy, what does it do? I would say, what's its function? I would say, but what is its meaning? Everything that exists has to be named, defined, has to have a function, but that's not enough. She's got to prove it to me now. We will believe anything anyone tells us. We are idiots. We don't ask anybody to prove anything. So what does she have to do? It's not enough just to say it's a thermos. She has to prove it's a thermos. Now, what does that mean? That means it has to fit the definition. It has to fulfill the function that you gave it in the definition, that it keeps my tea warm, sweetheart. So she has to prove it to me. She'll put the lid on. She'll fill it with tea. She'll leave it over there. 2 hours later, we come back. We take off the lid, and it's still hot. She just proved that it is a thermos. This is the rigor. This is what's called science, people. This is the rigor we need to define what exists even conventionally. Now we can begin to discuss it ultimately. So this is the point now. This is the point. I mean, one of the many points. So there you've got a prison. So what's a prison, mummy? Well, darling, especially in this country, there are some that are nice, but in general, a prison is this ugly-looking building with barbed wire, high walls, and the rooms are ugly, and the food is terrible, and you're sent when you're naughty, and you can't leave. That's a fairly good definition of a prison, you know? Now, that's a prison. Okay, if you're in Norway, I always quote, my friend in Norway emailed me a couple of years ago. He was so excited, looking forward to going to prison for 2 years. He was in the country. It was a beautifully made place where you get education, get care, a job, get taken care of. He was looking forward to it. It's not like that in this country, not in other countries either. So the point is this, people. There is conventionally a thing called a prison. It is a place that's usually ugly, not always. It is a place when you're sent where you're naughty or you're thought to be naughty, and it is a place that you can't escape from. They are facts, and you prove it by seeing the big keys. I've been to prisons. I can tell you it's true. It fits the definition. You can't escape. Some people try. Now, that fits the definition of a conventional phenomenon called a prison. This person here on my right is conventionally labeled correctly the person called Donna. There's Susie there. There's Linda here. There's Nico there. And there's Lou here. I can see you few people. Kimberly and Carmen. That's it. So we can fit the definition of each of those people. So conventionally, there is a Donna. There is an A on the wall. There is a prison. There is a thermos. But this is the point. This is the thing here. What ego grasping does, what ignorance, the root delusion does instinctively and automatically, it over-exaggerates the actual ontological status of the Donna, the thermos, the prism, the A. And we assume, the ignorance causes us to assume that it is in its bones a prism, it fixed as a prism, totally set in stone as a prism. So because, conventionally speaking, if you have the choice between, you know, a lovely place with open gardens and you can come and go when you feel like it, or an ugly prison, nobody in their right mind would not choose the lovely place. Conventionally speaking, it fits the definition of a prison where you can't escape. No one will want to go there. So conventionally, that's the truth. But what we do, we over-exaggerate the prisonness of the prison, and all these other emotions come on top, like the attachment, not getting what it wants, the aversion, the shame, the anger, the resentment, the pride, all this vomit goes on top of it. And so it becomes an evil, horrible, depressing experience. And then if you said to somebody, well, you could learn to change your mind and think it's nice, they'll think you're insane. Well, that's what that woman did. That's applying emptiness. It doesn't have an intrinsic nature of prison. Of course it was a shitty place. She was seen as an animal. She was treated like the worst of the worst in this country, as a person who feels a policeman. I mean, I've been to some prisons. The way the people see the prisons is like they're animals, you know, evil. No redemption for them. So it is a horrible place. You are treated badly. The food is terrible. I've eaten at Kentucky. Nice people, but the food was pretty horrible, I tell you, with the prisons I ate one day. So those are conventional facts. That is an A on the wall, it's not B. That is Donna, it's not Fred, but not from Donna's side, not from the side of the A, not from the side of the prism, not from the side of the thermos. They're merely labeled thermos, but it still fulfills the function of thermos. When we say, oh, it's made by the mind, in our culture that means it's just nonsense, it's all made up. Oh, it's only in the mind, it has no basis. It's the exact opposite for the Buddha. The mind creates everything. And that's why we can change our mind. Things don't have an intrinsic nature. Now, that, as soon as we hear it's empty of intrinsic nature, we think, well, maybe the prison's not that bad after all. That's not what's being said. No. Saying the Donna is empty doesn't mean there's no Donna. In fact, empty Donna proves there's dependent arising Donna. Empty prison proves it's a dependent arising shitty, horrible place, and you wouldn't want to go there. This is the thing, that emptiness reinforces existence, not diminishes it, which is the instinct we have. So seeing something from another point of view is utterly profound. It's kindness and patience and humility, but it is applying dependent arising. Now, my friend Sunny, I talked to her on the phone, she's not interested in Buddhism. She has no interest in karma. She's got the ability to be this way because she's got this marvelously intelligent mind. You know, she doesn't see it that way herself. Are we communicating, folks? Any questions at all? No? Nothing in the chat box, Donna?
No questions yet. Let me check.
Kim has a question. Sweetheart, yes, talk to me. Hello, darling.
Hello. Thank you for your teaching. I want to run something by you to see if you think I'm on the right track. So when you talked about the last time about Donna and the thermos in her eyes, seeing it as pink, and then if they were corrected, she would see it as black. If we changed it just a bit and said, she sees it as pink, and then someone comes and says, but you know what, it's actually black. And she says to herself, okay, I trust this person, so I'm going to tell myself, it's not really pink. It's not really pink.
Sure, okay.
This is what
it's
I
good.
Find. Yes, it's good.
Good.
And this is what I find
it's a good
myself.
Starting point.
I find myself doing this, like seeing things as dependent arising, saying, okay, this is not inherently existing. But
that's
because
right.
They look that way, I have to keep arguing.
That's right.
I have
that's
to keep saying, well, no, yes. It's really not that way. Look at it, Kim.
That's
look
right.
At it. But because I feel like as long as I'm dithering, and I'm not judging, it's a good thing I do, but as long as I'm dithering with the fact that it's not inherently existent, I never be able to see what it really is, which is like black for the thermos. I mean,
So what do you think the process, what is the method that you've been telling, that you've been studying all these years, as you've been studying, you've been learning it? I mean, you've got to start with that attitude,
yeah.
But eventually
yeah.
You've got to fix, you've got to get to see it at a subtle level where you then finally, this is the point now, Donna, this is the point, Kim, this is where you keep not believing in your karmic appearances, which puts atomic bombs under the habit. But it's not until you've got single-pointed concentration, where you've accessed the subtler level of your mind, that it's only then, after much analysis, much hard work, much purification, much doing what you're talking about doing in your daily life, that eventually, one day, your mind will be subtle enough and all the obstacles will have gone. And then for the first time, you will see the truth. That it is not pink. You'll see it nakedly. That the truth of it will appear as crystal clear to you. So that this is part of the practice to get there. You don't only do what you're doing, but this is a major thing to do which can help calm us down in daily life. It's huge to do what you're doing. It's like atomic bomb under it. But eventually, with much logical arguments like we're talking here, and much practice and much purification, and then eventually you get shamatha, and in one day in your single point of concentration, you will see for the first time that there never has been, isn't, and never could be the pink thermos, the self-existent me. And that's when your first moment of a direct realization of the emptiness of the fantasy I.
Oh. All right.
So keep moving, honey. Keep moving. Do you understand?
Yes.
Good. Thanks. Keep moving, darling.
Yeah.
You're going in the right direction. In fact, the practice of reminding yourself that your eyes are lying to you, that actually it's not pink, even though the habit has been this way for so long, is such a powerful practice. You're not just kind of crossing your fingers. You're not being wishy-washy. It's a profound practice. Because the biggest tragedy now is, as Lama Zopa says, it's bad enough that we see things wrongly, but the worst thing that keeps us paralyzed in the prison of samsara is believing it is true. And that's what Sunny was able to do in prison, which kept her sane. She knows she was in a prison. She must have gone out of her brain with these inaccurate accusations, a husband being executed, losing her children, her parents dying, one nightmare after another. The processing she had to do must have been unbelievable. But at some point, finally, I realized I couldn't change it. So she changed her mind. And then the result is, I mean, when I've met many people who've been in prison for years, especially wrongly accused ones. And it is it's brutalizing emotionally. Prisons kind of infantilize you. Then you're like an infant, and as well as being brutalized and horrible. Not every prison, of course, but generally speaking, especially if you're innocent. So there's this bitterness in people's minds and this kind of brokenness emotionally. When you meet Sunny, she's like this. She is literally a little old lady now in a wheelchair with this happy-go-lucky, funny little lady, like you'd never in a million years get any indication she's been through those 17 years of hell, because she worked on her mind. She changed the way she saw things. It's very profound, that Tim. I have such admiration for her. Any other questions, people? Yes, somebody. Terrible sound.
It's Andre, Venerable.
Oh, Andre, talk to me, darling. I can't see you. What a pity, but talk to me.
Can you hear me okay?
Very difficult.
Oh, my gosh. I have everything turned off.
Okay, try and just speak close to the mic, and I can hear you in an echoey way. So go on, talk to me.
Okay. I'm going back to the Ikea Donna. All right.
The what?
You said the
what?
Ikea Donna.
Ikea's Donna. Yeah, the Donna we bought at Ikea. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right. So you see, there's these different parts in the box that make up Donna.
Yeah.
But there is no I.
There's no peace. There's no piece called I. There's a nose, a toe, a ligament, an ear, but there's no piece labeled I.
Got
yes,
it.
Right.
So what connects the parts then? When we say
what,
I...
You mean what makes Donna function without an I? Very exactly.
Well,
all the parts do their... Because the parts do their job. The little finger does its job. The big finger does its job. The mind, the main boss, honey child, Adam... who's talking again?
Andre.
Andre, the main boss is the mind, Andre, your past karma, the programming, your intention, your attention, your love, your compassion, your kindness, your intention, your discrimination, all the thousands of the parts of your mind are what keep everything together. Your mind is the boss, darling. Okay. The mind is the boss.
All right. Yeah. I think I almost got it.
You see, we are so determined. We don't have this deep analysis of the mind, the same type of analysis in modern psychology, because we just think of it as another part of the brain, right? But these parts of the mind, everything that you are is done by your mind. The body is just this lump of caca. The body has no power from its own side. Everything is run by the mind. The entire universe is created by the mind. Hell realms are created by the mind. Heaven is created by the mind. Universes are created by the mind. The mind is the boss. When we know the power of the mind, Andre, who needs a pathetic little self?
Okay. Thank you.
But the mind is also empty. When you start to search for the intrinsic mind among its parts, you won't find that either.
Thank you. I'm with you.
Good, Andre. Well done. Anybody else? Anyone else? No? No questions?
Venerable Rabina, can I ask a question, please?
Yes.
All right. Could you speak?
Who is it? Because I can't see.
It's Diane. Mara.
Diane, good darling, talk to me.
All right. So my question is, could you speak for a minute about the other mistake? Because I feel like I have more trouble with that one, which is where it seems like all of them are
together. Exactly. So the one mistake is the extra little piece that runs everything. And the other mistake, which is equally common for us, is that all of the bits are me. Well, this is the point that they try to get this first establish this point, that if something exists, you have to point it out, and it has to be, and then you say something else exists. So it's either going to be one thing or it's going to be more than one. So, for example, you take the one part called the mind. You say, well, my mind is my eye. Well, that's two words. So if you've got a mind, you have to point out one thing, and then you have to, and you say, I have an eye, then that word eye has to point to another thing. So there's one option. You either have a thing that's called an eye and a thing that's called a mind. That's two. Or if you say they're the same, then there's just one thing. You would not ever then say the words, I have a mind. You would never say my mind. You wouldn't say that because I and mind are synonymous. So that's the first thing. Now, one of the contradictions in that argument is this. First, you establish, who's talking again?
Diane.
Diane. Okay, good. So the label for the person here is Diane. Then we have to establish, like the thermos, what is a Diane, mummy? Well, Diane is the name for a person. Well, what's a person, mummy? Well, a person is a word for person is the word we use to refer to a phenomenon. This is a broad definition, not quite exact, that has a body and a mind. So the components of a person are a body and a mind. Do you agree with that? Do you agree with that?
She's probably got mute. Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay, the components in this Buddhist analysis, the components of you, there are two. There's a body and there's a mind. So a body and a mind are the basis of the label. I'm sorry, I keep getting your name. What was it again?
Diane.
Diane, sorry, that's right. I'm sorry, I've got a cough. Wait. I don't want to cough in your face. I don't want to leave either. Where's the thing to stop me talking? God almighty, where is it? I hate that iPad. I can't bear it. Mute. So Diane is the name we give to the person, and the person, a person, you are validly fitting the definition of a person, because we just say this, use this definition, it's not quite accurate, but a person is a name we give to a combination of a body and a mind. So you have to have, so the body and the mind is the basis of the label I. So if it's the basis of the label I, they can't be the same. That's the type of argument you have to think. If the I is the mind, then you would never say, I have a mind. You would say, there's I and body, and you change the name mind, and you turn it into the word I, and it's a different phenomenon altogether. And if you say the body is the mind, the body is the I, when you say the same problem. Then if you've got 57 parts of your body and 1,000 parts of your mind, the logical deduction has to be that you've got 57 eyes and 1,000 eyes. So as many bits that you've got would be as many eyes that you have, and that's just plain silly, you know. So another one is this, the thermos is more simple. You know, the thermos is the name we give to the valid basis, which is the parts, the flat-bottomed metal pieces, the flat, you know, the sides and the piece, the bottom. This is these are the pieces that are the valid basis for the label thermos. So what you're trying to do is find where the thermos is. Well, the thermos must be the pieces, we say. Naturally, the body and the mind are Rabina, we say. Then that means the pieces are the thermos. Well, what is the thermos? Thermos is a thing that keeps your tea warm. So then if that's the case, then there's the base. So let's say we say, well, there's the thermos. There's the base and there's a side. It's two things. So let's say we take the base away. There's the base. Now, where's the thermos? So if the thermos is the base and the sides, then you have to label, you're going to have two thermoses. I mean, it doesn't make sense to us. So the thermos is the name we give to the valid base. It's not exciting in the beginning to hear this, you know. It's not comfortable because we've never thought about there not being an eye, for goodness sake. It sounds like a joke to say there's no eye, you know. There's no a separate eye. So the parts aren't the thermos. The body and the mind aren't the Dayan. That's a label we give upon those bases. The A is not those lines. A is the label we give imputed by the mind upon those lines. Now, the other one is, if prison were the bricks and the fences and the guards, all the components of a prison. The components of a prison are the building and the people who work there, let's say. If that was intrinsically the prison, then my friend Sonny could never have the thought, well, I've decided I'm in a cave and I'm going to meditate instead. She could not possibly have done that. She would have only one choice but to suffer because it's ugly. If you define a prison as an ugly place, if it's intrinsically ugly, you could never relabel it. If prison were intrinsically ugly and made, therefore it would have to make everybody suffer. And this is clearly not true. I mean, if the cake were intrinsically the cake, if the chocolate and the eggs and the flour were intrinsically the cake, then and we say it is the cause of happiness, and indeed the first mouthful is, but if it's intrinsically the cake, the consequence of that would be the more cake you eat, the happier you would get. And we know that's not true. So seeing something from another perspective is seeing something as a dependent arising, as merely labeled. So the prison was, when she didn't say it's merely labeled, I realized emptiness, Rabina. She didn't say that. She decided it was something different. Consequence of that is she was able to retain her happiness, you know. When things are set in stone, when things are intrinsically, inherently, independently, especially from the mind, this or that, then the fact is the Buddha says they can't even exist, you know, they're not even possible to exist. And I'm going beyond your point. So we've got to think those things. If the mind were the eye, then they're the same thing. We can see it can't be the mind because we just decided that I is the label that you put upon the combination of a body and a mind. Anyway, that's some food for thought, darling. I don't know if it's helpful or not.
Oh, it is helpful. Thank you.
Good.
Could I try re-saying it just one way? the basis is not the label because you can relabel it? Is that one way?
Well, the basis is not the label. No, because the basis is not the label, you therefore can relabel it.
Okay.
And this
okay.
is the point about, now go back to the point about I said about function. You can't just call this anything you like. You can't just say, oh, that's a knife. It has to function as a knife. You can't just say anything is a thermos. It has to function as a thermos. You can't, but so the prison, you could argue it's not a cave if you think of a cave as something in a mountain in Tibet. That's a concrete view, but it's functioned as a cave. Your own room could function as a cave if you decide not to leave it and have a strict schedule and meditate every day. So it fits the definition, but the thing has to fit the definition. You can't just say, oh, I'm living in the clouds. No, you're not. It's not a fantasy. You can, if something fits the definition, then you can relabel as much as you like. But it's got to be, you can't just call anything anything. It's got to fit the definition. This is a very powerful thing. It's got to function as that. So, you know, you could use anything as a knife. I mean, I've got a lid here. It's got a sharp edge. It could function as a knife. But this had quite difficult to function as a knife. But it could manage if the thing were very big. So it's got to function as that. It's got to function. That keeps it grounded. Do you understand?
I do. Thank you very much.
Good, good, good. So the thing, I mean, we can see in our daily lives, look how much happier it would be if we had enough wisdom to catch our mind when you're getting mad at your sister or mad at the kid or mad at the car in front of you, and you've got a fixed label, this horrible person, and then you see it from another point of view. You suddenly think, and that's why the multitude of arguments you can use, you can have kindness, you can use patience, they're all just different ways of seeing that fixed scenario as different, and immediately your mind will calm down. That's the point, too. That's why Sunny stayed sane, not just sane, but became fulfilled and more compassionate and more wise, because she was able, miraculously, to deal with this nightmare. But also the thing is, she knew she couldn't change anything, but she didn't just give up. She never stopped working on her freedom, and she got it eventually. So it's a very powerful example, I think. And all my friends in prison are really practicing. Mitchell on death row in Kentucky, he's amazing. He's really a devoted, sincere practitioner, 30 years, you know, just sitting there very happily in his red jumpsuit, going through the whole process of accepting the reality of what he did and, you know, and admitting his mistakes and then transforming his mind. And he's just the dearest man. He's completely content in this garbage dump prison in Kentucky, you know, getting ready for that electric jolt, as he said, because he's changed his mind, you know. And the thing about emptiness also, you see, a bird has two wings. Compassion on its own is not enough, and emptiness on its own is not enough. And that's why when we understand a bird needs two wings, but there are specific practices to get compassion and bodhicitta, and there are specific practices to get wisdom. But then every time you do one, it helps the other. So every time you think about emptiness, it helps you loosen the grip of ego and become more compassionate. Every time you practice compassion and forgiveness, it loosens the grip of ego grasping and helps you realize emptiness. So they both help each other, which is very, so beneficial to see, you know. Because finally, when, you know, as Lamayeshi says in Mahamudra, one of the consequences of ignorance, the root delusion that believes in the me, is the very construct of other. And finally, when we have become a Buddha, literally they say there is no longer any sense of a separate me. It's as if our I is as big as the universe. You can't separate. I mean, that sounds sort of pretty cosmic to us. Because it's the ego grasping that causes me and you and all the other dramas. You know, the mind has created all of this. So kindness itself is unbelievable. Compassion, bodhicitta. But you can lose even bodhicitta. You can lose even bodhicitta. But you can never lose emptiness because you've cut the root. And that's why bodhicitta on its own is not enough. And that's why emptiness on its own is not enough. And that's why, too, I've heard, I don't know how accurate this is, but I've heard, because you see, emptiness itself is a Theravadan teaching. It doesn't belong to the Mahayana. It's not a Mahayana teaching in its nature at all. And if you were on the Theravadan path, if you're on the wisdom wing, you do the first scope, you abide by the laws of karma, you then watch your mind, you then become your own therapist, you'd get renunciation, you'd get some concentration, and you'd realize emptiness, and in one life or other, you would have cut the root of all delusions, and you would have achieved your nirvana, and at the end of that life, you zap into bliss. You don't come back. So that's the danger, because the mind, I mean, Lama Yeshe talks about this in Mahamudra, that some of the qualities we would accomplish just getting single-pointed concentration. You can be forgiven for thinking you're not liberated. The mind is so astonishing when it's concentrated. You have unbelievable experiences of most astonishing bliss that you can't imagine. Unbelievable experiences of huge vastness of mind. So many qualities you can't believe just getting single-pointed concentration. So the biggest danger is if you start to realize emptiness, there's so much bliss, you will forget all about sentient beings. So in this Lamrim presentation, we leave concentration and emptiness till the very end, because you make sure you get some bodhicitta first, and because it's bodhicitta that drives the bodhisattva to even want to realize emptiness. They're going to get the bliss, but it never throws them. It never deters them, because their bodhicitta is so enormous. So it really makes sense. What else, people? What time is it? 6 o'clock, 5 o'clock. Oh, we've got another whole hour. How long was it? 2 hours in that session? Or hour and a half?
Two hours.
Okay, good. So, okay, we started on this, I think, but let's talk a bit more. That where we get very confused about the word itself, emptiness. You know, and what we've got to get used to is this. Okay, that there are sort of obviously a simple kind of phenomena that you can see and hear and taste and touch and smell. You know, like you see a cup and you can hear sound. They're fairly easy types of phenomena that exist, and we can all say they are a phenomenon. They are an object of knowledge. They are an existence. There are about 6 synonyms when you first study Buddhist philosophy. So the definition of an existence, or they're all different synonyms, object of knowledge, object, phenomenon, existent, established base. They're all different terms used to refer to whatever exists. So now the Buddha's whole point is this. Because of delusions, we are making up fantasies, things that don't exist. Like the cape that attachment sees does not exist. The eye that ignorance sees does not exist. So we've got to learn to be in sync with what does exist. So that's one point. Now, the next thing is, the way the mind functions, it cognizes a phenomenon. Whatever the mind cognizes, that thing is called a phenomenon, an existent, an established base, an object of knowledge, an object. The mind cognizes things, if you like. Now, there are two kinds of phenomena. There are the ordinary, simple, obvious things made of the 5 elements or the mind itself or whatever. And they're easy to see with things that we can see with our senses, you know? Then you've got more subtle phenomena that like the, you know, and an example of one of those is the absence of something. So this is why I talked about the absence of pink for Donna. It's a simple example. The absence we are all trying to cognize is the absence of the intrinsic I. So the thing is this, when we hear emptiness, we hear it leads to nothingness, and nothingness is not an object. Nothingness is not a thing, you know, so we just think it's nothingness. That's not true. So emptiness, so absence of the word emptiness, absence, lack, you could argue they're all synonymous, you know. If I pick up my cup and expect there to be tea, and I'll go, oh, my cup is empty. What I'm saying is my cup lacks tea. If Donna sees a black thermos, but her mistake is she sees it as pink, when we fix her eyes, she's going to go and say, oh, it's not pink. If she thinks there's $5,000 in her bank and looks in the bank and she discovers there's nothing there, she'll go, oh, where's my $5,000? You know, in each case, the thing that our mind cognized is a phenomenon called the absence of $5,000, the phenomenon called the absence of tea, the phenomenon called the absence of pink. So they are a real phenomenon. Because it says there's no tea, we think it's a nothingness. But mind doesn't merely see nothing. This is the point again. Try and hear this one. If Donna simply saw zero in her bank account, that's nihilism. That's nothing. It's true. It's nothing. She doesn't see nothing. She sees the absence of her precious $5,000. That's a very rich, delicious phenomenon that Donna cognizes. When she you know, gets her eyes fixed and she sees for the first time that the cup isn't pink. She sees this rich, powerful phenomenon called the absence of pink. It's a delicious thing. The absence of something isn't nothingness. So again, the example. If I look in Donna's bank, I will see the phenomenon, the object that I cognize is called zero. That's the object I cognize. When Donna looks in the bank, she must see the zero first, because then she can see that her thousands aren't there. But the object that she cognizes is not nothingness. It's the absence of something, $5,000. So that's what emptiness is. It's the absence of the thing we thought was there. So in other words, as Holiness says, it's not as if you start searching in that IKEA box and you chuck out all the bits looking for the eye and you throw out all the bits onto the ground, searching frantically for the Donna bit, and you will end up with nothing. You will end up, there will not be a Donna piece in there. But this is the point. The premise is that's not just the end of the story. Oh, well, there's no eye. Might as well kill myself. Chuck out the box. There's no Donna left. No, you'll then discover, and that's where the IKEA bit falls down. The Donna's dependent arising. So emptiness then is a vivid, real, delicious, powerful thing that does exist. So if tea did exist in my cup, then you could say the phenomenon my mind cognized in my cup is called tea, a completely reasonable statement. But if there's no tea in my cup and I expected there to be tea, then the name of the phenomenon that existed in my cup at that moment is called the absence of tea. So if tea existed in the cup, then the absence of tea also exists in the cup. It has to. This is why in the Heart Sutra we began discussing this. Lord Buddha tells us, where you will find form, for example, you will find right there the absence of inherent form. And wherever you find the emptiness of inherent form, it can be nowhere else except right there on that form. So you can't have, so you change the words to I. I is empty. And emptiness is I. I is nothing other than emptiness. And emptiness is nothing other than I. Meaning, I is the label for these bits. When you realize the emptiness of I, emptiness is a characteristic of what? Of I. So wherever you find the I, you're going to find right there on those parts the phenomenon called the absence of intrinsic I. So Donna, use the word Donna. Donna is empty. Emptiness of, okay, we'll spell it out. Donna is empty of inherent existence. Wherever there is emptiness of inherent Donna, you're going to find right there Donna. And Donna is empty and emptiness is Donna. You can't separate them. That's why the two truths must go together. It's not nihilism. Because emptiness of inherent existence is simply a characteristic of Donna that does exist. So dependent arising, as Lama Zelpa says, when you realize from the side of Donna, Diane, whoever you like, there's not a fraction of any Donna, any I there. But he says, there is an I, dependent arising. Dependent arising I, a merely labeled I. But what does exist is so subtle, it's as if it doesn't exist. So these two, I mean, it's just an extra way of saying it. Let me say his way of putting it, you know. So there is an I, but you can't point it out. It's not separate. It's not separate and it's not independent. It's the thermos and the iPhone are separate and independent. That's simple. But the ear and the eye, the ear and the person, you can't separate. But they're separate. But they're not, they're different, but they're not separate. An ear is not a nose, and a nose is not an ear. No, sorry, an ear is not an eye, and an eye is, I mean, a person, and a person is not an ear, but you can't separate. Donna is the name for the parts, but you can't separate them, but they're different. Donna is not the parts, but they're not separate, but they're different. They're different, but they're not separate. They're different, but they're not separate. You can't separate, or you can't separate the emptiness of Donna from Donna. Emptiness of Donna is not Donna, and Donna is not the emptiness of Donna. Although the Heart Sutra says it is, but it doesn't mean exactly that. But you can't separate them. So these are the things we've got to get used to. I mean, just squeeze our brains, okay? That's how they talk. So emptiness is a phenomenon. It's a thing that exists, and the mind cognizes it. So it's not nothingness. It's something. But it's like a negative number instead of a positive number, that's all. It's like it's a negative phenomenon, not a positive phenomenon. Put it like that. So we've just got to get our head around this, and then we can begin to use the right language to discuss it, and then we can think about it properly. If we've got the right words, we can think about it. We can meditate on it, you know? Any questions, people? Hello? Something? Anything? Anybody? So the whole, okay, so then ask sometimes, what's the point of all this? I mean, stop squeezing our brain. What's the point of this? Well, it's like I said, you could argue because Sunny, you know, because she had the karma, the mind, the patience, the wisdom, the power, the determination, that she could see her environment differently. It was prison. She was unfairly accused. You know, all those things are facts, but she had this wisdom that enabled her to navigate it. Because what happens otherwise is the point. What happens otherwise is the point. I remember reading at the same time as reading about Sunny, about this man who was also wrongly accused, also on death row. And he would be what we call normal. He went completely out of his brain, you know. He went completely crazy. And this is not uncommon. Look at the level of suffering in this world when people have such terrible suffering. And the suffering is real. Being tortured, being harmed, being brutalized, you know, the suffering of millions of humans. It is truly enough to make everybody go completely crazy. Now, you analyze it this way. Why do people go mad? Because we have ego grasping that clings to an eye that's set in stone, and whatever happens to us, we see it as intrinsically existent. We think we have any view of karma. We have no view of any other way. So we see it through the lenses of ego grasping. We see it through the lenses of attachment, the lenses of aversion. So we go mad. This is exactly why sentient beings suffer, because our minds are set in stone. This is the tragedy of the suffering of samsara. When we hear it, we just hear it criticism, you know. We should have such compassion. And then because we don't understand karma, oh my God, you know, there's no way we know why all this stuff is happening. That's the part that absolutely destroys most of us. Now, curiously with Sunny, I talked to her, I mentioned karma. She never thought about karma. She just, it wasn't her mind. But she had this other ability to see it differently that caused her just to survive, you know. It was very fascinating. She's not interested in karma. She has no interest. I mean, people have all kinds of minds, you know. So fascinating. And it's the same, I mean, you hear so many stories like this. People who can survive outrageous situations because they change their mind. That's always the key. So it's sort of obvious. If, you know, this fellow who was wrongly accused, he did not rape and murder anybody, he would scream daily, I did not rape and kill that woman. That was true. He didn't. But look at his response. Because the ego grasping was there, the belief in the intrinsic I, no view of karma, very intense attachment to get only the nice things. Join the universe, people. Then intense aversion and anger and rage when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And then the unbearable insult of arrogance and pride, being offended because you've been accused of doing something you didn't do. You've got the worst reputation on the planet. You're locked in this place. You've lost all your freedom. Then when that's set in stone and you can't see it around any other corner of it, then of course the only solution is to go crazy. This is the point the Buddha's making. We can't hear it. We're so convinced that he's suffering because he's in prison, wrongly accused. No, that's not the reason. That's the secondary reason. The main one is because his mind. That's why Sunny didn't suffer so much, because she was able to change her mind. This is the point that Buddha's making. So it's intense. It's really intense. Not that easy, you know. And this is what he says is the source of samsara. And what he means by samsara is the suffering we all have. We don't understand karma, so we don't know why things happen. That's why we mostly go mad. I mean, that's why we mostly go mad. We don't know why. Most things, why is this happening to me, we will say. Now, again, curiously, Sunny didn't think that much. She didn't think that question. She had this extraordinary ability to be patient and clear and strong-willed and determined, and she changed her mind. I knew I had a choice, she said. So what different approaches, you know? So why we suffer is because we don't know why things happen and because our minds are set in stone. We have tunnel vision. We see things according to what's in our mind and then we believe it's the truth. That's why we go mad. So to be able to be flexible, you know, that's why to start by not believing the cake is intrinsically delicious, not believing the person out there isn't intrinsically bad or whatever it is we think, you know. So it's really hard to distinguish between facts and fiction. This is the real point the Buddha's getting to, you know. We've got to distinguish between facts and fiction. So there are conventional facts. It's being a prison is simply a convention. It's a truth. Emptiness doesn't argue, it doesn't deny that it's a prison. Emptiness just simply lets us know that it's a dependent arising prison. So we can learn to see it differently. It's very intense. And the purpose of any of this is only to make us happy. No other reason. Not just to pass our philosophy exams. It's to be happy. And then to be able to benefit others. You know, that's the point. To smash the eye, the separate eye. And the fears. They talk about the fears of samsara. That's just the way they talk about living in normal fears. If we look at the delusions, their function is fear. Ego grasping in particular, the root delusion. Its nature is fear. And all the other branches, like attachment and anger and the rest, they're all their flavor is fear. We don't think of it like that. But look at daily life, all the anxieties and the worries. That is polite words for fear. So our minds always, when as long as it's got delusions and we haven't got concentration, we haven't realized emptiness, when our minds are just always distressed to one degree or another, you know? And the more we see our minds, the more we're going to see this. And when we finally realize emptiness, there is no fear. Fear is gone. You are now blissful. I mean, hear these words. They're serious words. Joyful, clear, see everything skillfully. Loving, compassionate. You add bodhicitta to the mix and then you're a Buddha. You know? It's very delicious. It takes time. Any other questions, darling? Come on.
I have a question.
Good. Talk to me. Yes, go, Nico.
When you were describing the...
Who's talking? I can't see Nico's mouth moving. Who's talking?
This is Tim. Tim.
Oh, I can't see you, Tim. I just seen Nico, and there was no sound coming out of his mouth. Okay, talk to me, Tim.
When you were describing the object and the absence of the object as emptiness, is that similar to negative space in art, in artistic design?
I think it's a good sort of analogy for it. But don't get too precise about it. I think it's a good analogy, like a negative number. You know, who can see a minus number? Nobody. You can't see -2. It's too weird. It's a bit like that. I'd say it's a useful way to sort of use it as an analogy, yes. But also, it's not too complicated either. Because you just got to get used to the idea that if I expect tea in my cup, and this is the interesting point I'm making here. The only person who would notice the absence of tea in their cup is the person who expects tea. The only person who would notice the absence of pink when you fix their eyes is a person who thought it was pink. The only person who would notice the absence of $5,000 in the bank is the person who expected $5,000. The only person who would see the absence of the intrinsic I, that's the person who's realized emptiness. The only person who will see the emptiness of the intrinsic I is the person who has believed in the intrinsic I, which of course is all of us. So the absence of something in this sense is only something that appears to somebody who believes in the opposite. Can you hear that?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. It's important points. It's kind of a contextual thing. It's not some absolute, you know. Entities are some absolute, like secret, like an alternative to God. I know you're not saying this. I'm just talking. The only, if you already know there is no intrinsic I, you don't need to realize emptiness, God Almighty. You already know it. You now know that the merely labeled I, you'd be in reality, you know. If you're not colorblind, you don't need to realize the damn thermos is not pink because you don't realize it's pink. You don't need to fix the problem. You've got no problem. I mean, I haven't got cancer, right? So I don't think, keep thinking, oh, I'm absent of cancer is empty, cancer is empty. I never thought I had cancer in the first place. So the absence of something is only going to be appearing to the person who thought it was there. And you think about this daily life, we suffer terribly. If you're always yearning for a boyfriend, you're always going to notice the absence of a boyfriend, aren't you? Think about that. We suffer so terribly. Like, you know, let's say I've been married to Andre for 42 years and suddenly Andre leaves me. And you never met Andre in your whole life and you have to come and visit me in my house. When you walk in that door, you will never notice the thing called the absence of Andre, will you? But that's all I'm noticing in that house. Every day I wake up, I notice the absence of Andre. So it's a really good analogy to think. But the only person who notices the absence of something is the person who either wanted it or thought it was there, you know? But that's why it's not enough to merely realize the absence of the I. You then realize the dependent arising I. It's like it's not enough to realize it's not pink. Donna then realizes it's black. It's the analogy, you know? That's why it's not, as His Holiness says, the eye isn't empty because you can't find it. You won't. That's not the real premise. It's because once you realize there is that eye that you thought was there, isn't, you then realize what does exist, which is so subtle, it's as if it doesn't, which is a merely labeled eye. That's the way to put it in. So it's an affirmative thing in the end. Is a way of talking. Anyway, is that okay, Tim?
Thank you. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Nico, what you got to say?
So I have a question about after last week I went outside and sat and I looked at a tree in the night and I thought to myself, I see a tree, and then I had a simultaneous thought thinking, he sees a lack of a tree. Or the absence of a tree at the same time. Is that conflating, like, sort of impermanence with emptiness, or...
Well, tell me what more the feeling that arose when you said you saw an absence of tree.
Like, I could see the tree was there, but I also thought of, you know, that it's equally true that that there is no tree there. That it is inherently... not there all at the same time.
I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying there is a tree there, but it's a merely labeled tree? You know, we've sort of called it a tree. I mean, if that's the case, it's that. But if you think it's kind of changing moment by moment, that's more the impermanence one, which is a good step. It helps us,
yeah,
leads us to emptiness.
I think it was
that's the one. So that's okay. That's a good step. Impermanence leads us to understand emptiness. It's a good stepping stone. It loosens the grip of the rigidity of it, you know?
Right. To see, yeah, it sort of through its whole spectrum of...
That's right, exactly. That's impermanence, and that's helpful. That's leading it. It's not as subtle as emptiness, but it's moving in the right direction. So it's easy to mistake them. In fact, in the different set, and when you study Buddhist tenets, one of the views of the earlier schools, their view of subtle, of gross emptiness, gross selflessness, is actually, for the next school, the view of subtle impermanence. So we've got to be very wise not to confuse them. But it's a stepping stone. It's a very good stepping stone. So you're in the right track here.
Thank you.
Okay, good, Nico. What else, darling people? No, nothing. Nothing to talk about. No questions. Okay.
I have another question.
Good. Go on then.
So you were talking about the lady in prison and sort of relabeling. And during meditation, sometimes I don't know whether it's a playful thing or not, but I relabel things in my mind as I'm thinking about them, but trying to keep it the label accurate to the function or whatever like that. So thinking like the at the very beginning, I am breathing in, and then eventually changing that or maybe playing with that a little and thinking he is breathing in.
Okay.
Or the person called Nicholas is breathing in.
Okay, that's loosening the grip a little bit. That's helpful. Yeah, that's good. That's just relabeling yourself. It's more spacious. It's true. Yeah, it's true. Nothing wrong with that. But I think the real application in daily life of this view of relabeling is every one of us, every second of the day, because every second of the day we're going to have, not every day, we're going to have problems, aren't we? But, you know, if we understand that the deep assumption, the kind of the emotional hunger called attachment, its main feeling is, and it's so instinctive, that it wants only the nice things every second. We all know that, don't we? We want the nice feelings, the nice taste, the nice smell, the nice weather, everything to go nicely. And that's what we call getting happiness, isn't it? That's in general, we know that's what life is. Now, we know that hunger, that attachment, many times gets what it doesn't want. Even the tiny example, and that's why we should start with just the small ones. Don't wait for your wife to leave you before you start to work on your mind. Don't wait till you're thrown into prison and accused of murder before you start working on your mind, in other words. So when the baby things happen, when attachment gets the wrong thing, when the coffee is the wrong temperature, your wife doesn't listen to you, the traffic is bad, the boss is mean to you, all our baby examples, they are the times to work on relabeling it. That's what Sunny did. And that's the source of sanity. That's called transforming problems. In other words, if we're really practicing that view, which is applying emptiness, then, you know, your wife is mean to you. Your kid doesn't do what you want. The traffic, you set, the traffic light won't change. The attachment's roaring to the surface and it's having a panic attack because it's not getting what it wants. So the mind gets very rigid and very set. This is happening. So if you're working on your mind and you catch yourself getting annoyed because your kid didn't do what you wanted, grab that and notice there's attachment not getting what it wants. Now that's aversion arising and you go, well, you know, I'm going to see it differently. And you don't just see it through the lenses of your thwarted attachment. You sort of see it from another point of view, which is what Holiness said. Then that's the source of sanity. That's what daily practice is. And this is preparing us to finally understand emptiness. It's a perfect preparation. And you understand what I'm saying, Nico?
Yes.
I mean, it's a stupendous practice. But I mean, the trouble is, we only notice what's going on in our minds when the really bad things happen. Whereas we should be watching our mind 1,000 times a day when attachment doesn't get what it wants. And then we get annoyed or frustrated. Everybody says they get annoyed, frustrated. And it's just a polite word for anger. Well, anger causes suffering in the mind, and that builds up. So no wonder one day, when you have days and days and weeks and months of moments of frustration that we've never dealt with, that we've never relabeled, then eventually you inert in bed with profound depression and can't get out of bed because you haven't never dealt with it for years. Or you want to kill your husband one day, and you realize, wow, I'm getting angry. But we've been getting angry 1,000 times a day, but we don't notice. This is a day-to-day practice of grabbing our minds, grabbing and seeing there's attachment, there's anger, and labeling the thing differently. You order your hot coffee at the shop. A tiny example. And it doesn't come quite the right taste. It's okay to ask for it again, but you catch your mind, you catch the annoyance, and you go, that's okay, Rabina, I'm going to enjoy the coffee. That's changing your mind. That's what Sunny did. That's a baby example, so get ready for the big examples, because we don't know when they're going to come. She didn't expect to go to death row. The last thing on her mind. You don't expect your wife to die on you. The last thing on your mind. So practice with the baby thing. But our trouble is in our culture, we just don't pay attention to the baby things. We just wait till the drama happens, you know. But frustration, annoyance, irritation, upset are polite words for mild anger. and they have a response when attachment is thwarted. This is daily life. This is what builds up into the big frustrations and the pain and the suffering and the misery. So we dealt, and this is the point, we're really just working at a simple level on our minds the best we can, like this, day to day, you would never lose the plot. You won't get a you wouldn't have a mental breakdown. You won't go crazy because you're dealing with each thing moment by moment by moment. It's like a miracle. I mean, we can't catch every moment, but we can catch 100 in a day, 200. Just don't be like dumb animals plodding through life until some drama happens, and then we wonder why we're not equipped to handle it. Because we haven't practiced every day. You know? This is changing your mind every second. Don't wait just to change your mind about emptiness, about the intrinsic nature of things. Change your mind about the over-delicious chocolate cake and the over-ugly boyfriend. All the constant views we're having all the time that we believe are true. This is where learning about delusions, the branch delusions, helping us get ready for emptiness when we start to realize that they're misconceptions. Then we're ready to hear how ego grasping is the root of misconception. This is day-to-day practice preparing us, you know, for loosening the grip of ego grasping. Time to go, isn't it? No, still more time. I keep saying time to go as if I have to go. But it's two more, it's still another 20 minutes, isn't it? We don't have to wait 20 minutes. Yes, good, darling. Talk to me, Susan. Yes.
I'm not sure how to answer, how to ask this.
Go on, then.
I want to be able to give up attachment to my body when I'm dying.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm wondering how to, if emptiness can help me in some way,
absolutely.
How I could think.
Okay. Absolutely, darling. So let's, hang on, let's fix my iPad again. What's going on? It doesn't work. Wait. Got all these extra bits and pieces here. Let's see what happened to my structure. Buddha. There's me. Go back to this. Okay, sorry, everybody. There she is. Okay.
Well, first of all, I think one of the powerful practices in daily life, isn't it, is to keep remembering that the I isn't the body. The body, I mean, we are so attached to our bodies, I think, as long as issues, we make the body the boss. And the main attachment at death, as long as in Lama's book, we talked about this in depth. I mean, Rinpoche's book, do you know Rinpoche's book? How to Face Death Without Fear?
Yes.
Yes, okay, brilliant. It's such a helpful book. So the real one is, first of all, realizing that death is the separation of the mind from the body. And if we're practicing in our daily life, we're practicing working on the mind. And we're knowing that our mind is continuing. So for the more and more we can get used to that idea and learn to know that the body has to finish, we've got to leave the body behind, you know, leave this gross body. So the more we don't identify with the body, the more we get give up attachment now to the body, not all the time look in the mirror, not all the time feel how fat we are, how thin we are, with the nose, this, the arm, that. We're very addicted to thinking about our bodies all the time because we define them as ourselves. You know, so every second of the day, be nice. I mean, have the body suffer attitude. It's good to have the body suffer attitude where you think you look nice for other people. You, even if you've got empowerment, then it's marvelous. This is really powerful to see yourself as Tara, as the Buddha, as Chenrezig, whatever Buddha you've done. They are marvelous practices, but it's your mind that turns into Chenrezig, not this bag of bones, you know. So the more we think that the bag of bones is here, we use it, it's useful, keep it healthy, keep it nice, look nice for other people, for body teacher, but learning in that way every day to give up attachment to me being the body. That's so important. And know that if you want to anything that you want to, that's more, the mind is more, you know, the mind is the one that continues. The mind is what you've got to train. So the more you practice into your mind, you give up fear, you give up attachment. And as Lama Zopa says, the main attachment at the time of death is attachment to this body, because that's what we think of as I. So then giving up that attachment, knowing, and that mind just means knowing that death is definite, knowing you're going to die, you could die today, reminding ourselves every day of this, and then focusing on what's important, focusing on practicing, focusing on your mind, then you'll be ready for death, and it won't be so fearful because you've been, you're prepared for it, you know. It's very practical. I mean, if you don't prepare for your driving test, then on the day you're going to full of fear, of course. Yeah, so preparing for it is the way to stop the fear, but remembering particularly that you're not your body. Your body's good. Don't use it badly, but it's just this gross piece of thing that will cease.
but your mind will continue with the subtler winds and then the karmic seeds you've got, and that will continue. And the other one is also the really crucial thing. Rinpoche mentions this in the book. It's so practical. It's the bodhisattva approach. We've got to give up attachment. There's no question. But attachment has many functions. So one function of attachment at the time of death is grasping at this body, holding on to something. But the other function of attachment which you can use is looking forward to something. So look forward to your next birth. Look forward to a new rebirth. I mean, it sounds weird for us to think of your new body, but just know that you want, you're looking for, so then when you look forward to the next one, like if you've got a Christian, mummy's Christian, tell her to look forward to going to heaven. Then she'll let go of this, you know. That's really powerful. And that's where to think about karma and want to get ready for the next rebirth. So, of course, if you think about Pure Lands and everything, look forward to going to Amitabha's Pure Land, you know. So that's really helpful. So at the time of death, you're not clinging to this. You're relaxing and your mind is focused on what's coming. And that's reasonable. I mean, you know, it's like that's everyday life we do like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John, it's very practical, that. That's very helpful.
I also think of how as I would be dying, my body would be changing. It wouldn't be useful.
That's right.
Why hold on to this? And if I can just let it go.
Sure. That's right. That's fine. But the emphasis has to be, though, the practice has to be throughout the life, though, isn't it? But focusing on your mind, knowing your mind will continue. That's why you've got to focus on what will continue. Mm-hmm. That's all. The body won't continue, but the mind will. So focus on the mind, because that's what you're going to continue. Your virtue, your goodness, your kindness, your patience, your faith, your devotion, they are the components you want to nourish, because they will continue. And this is the thing that they say in the technical process of death. The karmic seed that determines your next life usually is triggered before you lose the plot, before you stop breathing. Mm-hmm. And then by the time this grasping kicks in, it's all very technical, isn't it? The grasping in the 12 links kicks in very powerfully where you're strongly grasping, and that brings fear. But if you've got the Dharma on your mind, if you have someone helping you navigate this process, then at that time when the virtue is in your mind, a virtuous karmic seed is triggered, and then they say your death will be very, very blissful. You'll be very peaceful and very joyful. So that's the crucial point where you need the support. At the time when the death process starts. I remember a friend of mine, an Australian fellow, who was married to an American. They lived at Vajrapani Institute in California. This is 35, 40 years ago. He fell off the roof, and he died in his wife's arms. And she said he was blissful, meaning at the time he died, a virtuous karmic seed was triggered, and he died a blissful death, very happy, very peaceful.
Okay.
So the key is to keep Dharma in your mind and be peaceful and focus on the thing that will continue, which is your mind. That's the point. That's what daily practice is, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you.
The body now is what you can use to help others. Then it's got a use, not just a bag of bones. Do you understand?
Yes.
That's important. Then you use your body, you know, for others. Okay. Thanks, Susan. What else, dying people?
I have a question.
Yes, talk to me. I can't see you, so say your name.
That's okay. Turkey. Turkey. Yes.
What's Turkey? Who's it? I don't know you. Do I, Turkey?
We've met. Yes, we've met along
the
way.
You're one of the nine at the center.
No, not full.
Okay.
That's fully ordained. No.
Okay, fine, so whatever. So go on, Turkey. Talk to me.
Thank you. So could you speak to... When one has a taste of that spaciousness where there's nothing intrinsically to hold on to, and there's really an experience, I'm working with holding that and somehow staying grounded in the body. At times it seems as though there's like a disconnect from the relative when the ultimate is sort of really palpable. And the blending and the integration of the two is really something that I find challenging at times. I tend to have much more of an easy time in the spaciousness, but holding that in to the daily practices of, you know,
no, that's
guru,
true.
You know,
that can be a problem.
Very
yeah.
helpful.
No, that can,
but
yeah,
I just wonder if you could speak to anything
yeah.
that you think.
Well, that can be a problem because the fact is, if we've got the spaciousness of our mind, if it's really in the right way, it reinforces reality of right now and brings you closer to others and closer to reality. If it's not, then, you know, you've said it very clearly. It's like, do you mean you feel disconnected from other people or the importance of things, or suddenly things don't seem to matter so much? How? Describe it a bit more.
Yeah. Yes. And yes, it's almost like there's almost a conscious disconnection from quote unquote reality, right? From the relative aspect of things, not to the degree of not recognizing the importance, but there just seems to be sometimes a difficulty for me coming like out of a retreat or, you know, when I really expanded and I've really tasted that coming back in, and it's almost like there's this futility to like
I understand. Well, I would say, okay, well, it seems to me that compassion is missing. The compassion is missing, darling, because that's the wisdom wing. You're talking about the wisdom wing, and that's really like the wish to get rid of suffering and go beyond this ridiculous life and everything is meaningless. You're absolutely correct. But if you lack the compassion one, the purpose of your being in this body and mind, yes, to get rid of delusions and to go and give up suffering, but it's got to be also grounded in empathy with others and compassion. So it sounds to me that you've got to emphasize that.
Because
if you're only doing the wisdom wing, then everything in you wants to get rid of out of samsara, and you will get out of samsara. And at one point, once you realize emptiness and you've achieved your own nirvana, you will not come back. But the thing that keeps you here, and that's day by day, is the addition of the reason you're here, which is to be a benefit to others. Then that is what keeps you grounded. So the joy that you will have will also be linked to compassion. But the joy on its own and the wish to get rid of stuff, suffering, that can be dangerous.
Understood. Yeah, I love that. Because good. I've had teachers tell me the exact opposite, so I feel like maybe the pendulum has swung further that way. I've had Lama Zopa, for one, said that one time that my compassion wing was stronger than my wisdom and that I needed more wisdom. And so maybe I've worked on that.
Okay. Well, now it seems like
I can come in the middle.
I mean, maybe, that's right. You've done the bit of the wisdom wing now, but you've forgotten about the compassion one. So that's a very interesting point. That's a very interesting point. It's just my thought, because that is, you see, if you were only on the wisdom wing, you would be in complete bliss and you would have no interest in this pathetic life. But that's a danger if you don't ground it in bodhicitta. But if bodhicitta on its own is also dangerous because you've got no ground in wisdom. So you've got to have the both, darling.
I lived in that for a while, and it almost swallowed me up. So I'm grateful.
There you go.
We've got to know
how to do these truths. Very powerful. Thank you so much, Chirky. Very helpful, darling. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good, thanks. What else, darling people? This last 10 minutes we've got together.
I have a request, please.
Yes, good. Who is it? I can't see you.
This is Link. Link Freedom.
Hello, Link.
Hello. I'm curious. I know the whole nature of this talk was about egos, the illusory nature of ego, but I really struggle with what it means to have a healthy relationship to ego and to have a healthy ego, because that's what I've been struggling with, is just like almost to the point of martyrdom, trying to throw away my sense of self and not have an identity,
So I think very much here, Link, it's a question, first of all, it sounds rather boring, but it really sincerely is a question of definition, you know. So we can eat, so what it sounds to me, okay, so the key thing in Buddhist psychology is that there's this clear distinction between the neurotic, I-based, ego-based, self-centered, painful, suffering, narrow states of mind that are the cause of all our pain. They're called ego grasping, attachment, anger, jealousy, low self-esteem, arrogance. We know these words. So if they are predominant, we suffer terribly and we harm others. Now, they're the function of ego in Buddhist terms. So giving up those doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater. This is the Buddha's entire point. The practice of giving up those means actually enhancing empathy, self-confidence, contentment, fulfillment, lack of attachment, lack of anger, lack of jealousy, lack of resentment. That means if you lack those, you don't end up throwing the baby out the bathwater. You are more self-content. You are more fulfilled. You are more joyful. You are more loving. You are more self-confident. We initially can't see that, but that's the point. Can you hear the words?
Yes.
So if you're, you know, throwing out self-confidence, you've thrown the baby out with the bathwater. You know, for example, you've got arrogance and you've got self-confidence. Use two simple examples, arrogance and self-confidence. Now, the nature of all the delusions in Buddhism is they're rooted in the separate sense of self. They are fear-based, they're neurotic, they're disturbing, they're distressing, and they cause you pain, and they cause you to harm others. But then you've got these other parts of you, kindness and empathy and self-confidence and goodness and humility. So when you lessen the neuroses, you grow the other ones, and they are the basis of what you just said, using your words, a healthy ego. But that's not the way they'd say it in Buddhism. That's the real you. So when you give up attachments, you become more fulfilled. You give up anger, you become more patient and kind and more open. When you give up arrogance, you become more humble and connected to others. We've got to see the difference in these negative and the positive states of mind. It's quite a unique approach in Buddhism. But we tend to, if we don't hear this distinction, we tend to throw the baby out with the bathwater, you know.
I think
you're hearing me?
Yeah, I'm hearing what the root of what you're saying. That's helpful. But to nitpick, it's like, how is the negative expression of mind not the real you, but positive, like, how is the yin not real, but the yang aspect?
I don't understand.
Well,
I know that word, but I don't use
it.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying, why is the negative aspects of mind, neuroses, like fear, jealousy, all these negative traits that we're trying to cultivate away from, not the real us? How's that not the real us? But then all these positive qualities, it's like the positive pole of the same magnet. The whole magnet.
Your question is, why is love something that's intrinsic in you, and why is attachment not something that's intrinsic? Is that your question?
I guess love is the positive expression. Why is fear? I wouldn't put love and attachment on the other side, because you already showed us that we can have healthy attachments. We can have a loving attachment that pulls us
forward. That's not the words that Buddhist psychology is using. I mean, I've got to use words in a very clear way. Otherwise, you're using words and I'm using words, and we've got different definitions. We'll never communicate, Link. So you can use whatever words you like. All I can do is use the words I know as according to the Buddhist definition, and if you can try and hear my meaning, then you can use them whatever words you wish. That's not the way Buddhism would say it. The point of Buddha's saying is that anger and attachment and jealousies and fears, which cause us to suffer, they cause us to suffer and they cause us to harm others. So, I mean, can you see that on a simple level, can you see how that's true?
I can see how that's true, but I don't see how that's not real.
Now is a good point. Can you see it's true that it causes pain?
Yes, I see it.
True that on the basis of attachment and anger, people harm each other? Have you noticed in the world that people harm each other? Have you noticed that?
Yes, I can see
it. Okay, good. So you do accept that it's causing suffering?
Yes.
Okay, all Buddha's telling you is that he has found a method to stop suffering by giving up the causes. He's just telling you what he has found. He's not asking you to believe that you should want to do this. But all he is saying is what he has found from his own inner work is that actually that these states of mind are like distorted, desperate, panic-stricken, cause me pain and cause me to harm others. That's real, and you've agreed. But he is simply saying he has found a method to give them up. And what would you be like if you gave up these things? You'd be infinitely wise, infinitely clear, infinitely powerful, infinitely compassionate, infinitely confident, infinitely joyful, infinitely wise. You'd have all those qualities. The Buddha would say he has found through his own direct experience that they are at the core of our being and that they are the source of our happiness and our ability to make others happy. That's his findings. And all he's suggesting is go check that out. Are we communicating a bit now?
Yes.
You don't need to agree with him. Or I hear your questions. I really do. But this happens to be his view. So then all he says is, this is what I found, and this is my methods for doing this. Go check it out yourself. You know, that's all he's saying.
Well,
so in other words, the person... Sorry, darling.
it's not about the, well, is that the path, or is that, I just really am confused about how is all those negative things illusory, like that's not our real self, but then all these positive expressions, if anything, it seems like
okay,
going
the Buddhist
to
reasoning
negative.
Behind all that, the Buddhist reasoning is, he says that the negative ones, the ones that cause us to be constricted, to feel fear, the reason they cause fear, the reason they cause us to feel constricted, the reason they cause us to live in la-la land, the reason they cause us to harm others is because of that fear. And the point about these states of mind, when we go very deeply into them, he says that they're not valid cognitions. They are out of touch with interdependence. They're out of touch with reality. That's the thing he's saying. It's like we're believing that 1 + 1 = 3. Where all these lies that our mind tells us, and that because they're lies, he says they're misconceptions at the root of our being, they can be removed. So he has found from his own experience, they are real, they happen, but he has found from his own direct experience that with the inner work, as we've been talking about, ever more subtle internally in meditation, we can unpack and unravel these misconceptions, these delusions, and we can discover for ourselves how they cause us to be out of sync with reality. And that's why we suffer, and that's why we harm others. So that's what he's telling us he has found to be so. And all we can do is try to, if we choose to follow it, and he says that they're adventitious. They're like extra bells and whistles that we don't need, that a valid person finally is a person who's rid completely of all the neuroses, all the fears, all the dramas, all the limitations. And that person is blissful, clear, and is fulfilled, and that's what he means by a Buddha. This is just what he has found to be true. And all we can do is listen to this and look into it and try to prove it, if it's true or not. In other words, you don't need to have anger to prove the opposite. You know, we tend to feel I'm not trying to insult your yin and yang. I don't quite understand it, but I used to use those words, but I don't quite know what I mean by it. We sort of feel the only way we can, and you're not saying this, but I'm just talking, to be happy is to know suffering. The only way I can, I've got to have the opposite. No, not at all. We only need love and compassion and kindness and wisdom and clarity, but that brings self-confidence and clarity and joy. This is just Buddha's finding, that's all. This is what he says. We have to look into if there's any validity to it. But the reason he's saying the virtues are core of our being is because they are valid cognitions. They are rooted in interdependence. The delusions are completely out of sync with reality. They cause us to live in la-la land. So everything comes down to reality. What is real and what is not? What exists and what doesn't? What do you think, Lynn? Food for thought?
Yeah, that's very helpful to look at it in those terms and to just really root into the nature of interdependence and
yes, that's right,
and what falls away.
Honey, you hit it on the head. In other words, it's not a moralistic thing or anything. He says it's... What a valid cognition is for the Buddha is one that's rooted in interdependence. Now, you check this. Let's say you and I are having a lovely chat, and anybody looking on can see that Link and Rabina are having a nice chat. That means what's happening? At that moment in time, I'm being loving to you because I'm thinking of you. I'm listening to you. I'm being empathetic. I'm hearing about your headache. You hear about my problems. We empathize. And look at us. We're leaning towards each other. We're listening to each other. We are in harmony. There's an interdependence there. Now suddenly look what happens when you insult me. Suddenly that sense of connected we is cut in half, Link. Suddenly the poor me, how dare you say that to me? And you say, how dare you say that to me? Look at the drama. But suddenly we're out of touch with reality. There's no longer any feeling of interdependence. There's just a feeling of separate, unhappy, neurotic me and mean, ugly, separate you over there. So it's rooted in interdependence.
What I'm proposing is that through that conflict or confrontation, that the trigger, it brings these things to the surface so that you can look at it later. I mean, if you were a deer and I was a tiger, would we be interdependent and I attacked you and I took you out and then the rest of the tribe, you know, like there's...
So I'm lost now. Now you're losing me. Start again. What's happening?
No,
what are you
telling me? Just
start
between
again.
Us and humans, if we could still be interdependent and have a conflict in which... you know, your illusory ego gets triggered and our mind gets insulted, and on the surface we're fighting each other and we're out of touch, we're out of that harmony.
Then that's useful material
for
okay,
our
good, good,
self.
Good. Now I get you. Listen, these, of course, it's useful. If you go skiing and you break your leg, it is useful to learn from that break. But honey child, the real lesson is don't break your damn leg again. You don't need to be punched. I don't need you to punch me in the nose, Link, for me to then have you forgive me so I can appreciate the forgiveness or whatever it is. You be kind to me, right? No, I don't need you to punch me and then kiss me for me to appreciate your kiss. I will, if I'm brave enough, Link, but look, most humans aren't, I will learn from the pain, but I don't want the pain any longer, baby. That's a fact. Then yes, it's a learning, but you don't keep having to punch each other to keep learning. You get my point?
Loud and clear.
What?
I said loud and clear. It's always a pleasure with you.
Cool. Okay, darling. Wonderful conversation. Thank you so, so much. Now it's time to go, and that's the end of our little talk. End of our series, Donna. We're gone. Gone like a dream.
Okay, Venerable. Shall we do some dedications? And
do a little. Yeah, keep it simple. What do you... I like to keep it simple, but heartfelt. So, don't put them up there. If you want to say some prayers, I want to say, let's think. Here we've been in several sessions or one session, whatever it is. Every second has been valuable. Every second is a seed we've planted. So we think maybe nourish these seeds from this moment forward with our effort, with our hard work, so that they do eventually manifest in our Buddhahood, no matter how long it takes, so we really can be a benefit to others. One step at a time in this process. How amazing. And then May, this amazing bodhicitta, which we haven't talked about, that is this marvelous aspiration, this shift in the mind that sees that we need to be of benefit to others. May that grow and grow and grow, and may it never decrease in the minds of the sentient beings. That's
may
all I want to say, baby.
Okay. May we offer a mandala, Venerable?
Do a short one. Yes, a short one.
Okay.
So what we're going to do, we're going to put on the prayer on the paper? We're going to put on the
screen? Yeah, put the prayer up.
Okay,
yeah.
So what we're going to do, you people, we're going to do this little prayer that we just visualize. Use your creative imagination. We're going to offer all the marvelous things of the world to the Buddha as a thank you for these teachings, you know? And, these two little prayers. This is very auspicious and meaningful. And if someone's going to offer the mandala, all we can do is see the prayer. We can't see the mandala. But someone's going to offer the mandala?
Yes, Venerable. I've got her spotlighted. It's Laura.
Oh, no, I can't. Oh, there she is down there.
Oh,
look
okay.
at that. How wonderful. Good, Laura. So Laura's going to actually do it, this physical thing of offering on behalf of all of us. And we imagine we're thanking the Buddha for all these teachings. How amazing. So who's going to sing it, Donna? You?
I'll sing it, yes.
You go, darling.
Saji Puki Juxing Meto Trom Ri Rav Ling Shi Nije Gen Padi Sange Jing Du Mite Uwai Drokunam Dag Jing La Chupar Shok Jetsun Lama Kun Se Rab Ten Ching Nam Ka Trin Le Chok chur ge padang lo zang ten pe trun me sa sung gi tro e mun sel tak tu ne gyur chik iram guru ratna mandala kam niriya tayami. And Venerable, we'd like to say a long life prayer if we may.
Okay, fine. It's good.
Okay.
Thank you, Laura. So kind on behalf of everybody. Wonderful, Laura. Thank you, darling.
Mother of the victorious ones of the three times and ten directions, Dharmakaya, the great bliss embraced by great compassion, my perfect Arya Tara, who in an ordinary form are the guide for us pitiful transmigrating beings left guideless, how kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. Almighty One, you who destroy all the enemy of delusions, who reveal the Dharma of scripture and realization, spreading in the mental continuum of transmigrating beings, thereby eliminating the two obscurations, including their imprints. How kind you are. May all your wishes be instantly fulfilled, and may your life be stable until samsara ends. By the blessings of the Guru, the deity, and the Dharma protectors, and unbetraying actions and their results, as well as the truth of ultimate reality, and all my lifetimes, may I only please and never displease for even one second the Guru, and may all the vital points of my prayers be fulfilled.
Okay. Thank you, dearest one. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, everybody. I wish I could see you all, but I can't. Now I can all I do is see me, and that's ridiculous. Where's the thing? There it is. Okay, darlings.
Thanks.
Next time.
Thank you,
Venerable. Never give up. Never give up.
Thank you.
We all never give up.
Thank you, Venerable.
Thank you, Venerable.
Thank you, Venerable.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Abhinav. Good night.
Thank you, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye.